Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Labor Day, Monday, the 6th of September. The author of The Company Town, The Industrial Edens and Satanic Mills That Shaped the American Economy, is our guest this hour. Hardy Green, former associate editor at Business Week, where he did the book review coverage. He has written for Reuters.com, Fortune.com, and AOL's Daily Finance, has taught history at Stony Brook University, from which he holds a PhD in U.S. history. It looks not only at those lousy companies that were really despicable toward their employees, but it also looks at these utopian companies that may have been a little paternalistic, but they were trying to create a lively community for their employees, including libraries and housing that wasn't all that bad. So we're going to be looking at the company towns, and our guest says by conservative estimates, there were more than 2,500 single enterprise towns once dotting this country. We'll welcome phone calls, and our number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you want to send an email, that would be okay. Talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. Hardy Green, thank you very much for being with us. Happy Labor Day to you.
Yes, thank you, Kathleen. How are you?
I'm all right. Thank you. Thanks for being with us. You start the book with a story, and people don't remember what this story is, when they hear Anaconda Copper Company in Butte, Montana, they'll think they have an association. Ooh, that was bad. Whatever it was bad. And it was a huge strike and really awful conditions. You start with that. It's, you think, one of the most egregious examples of companies being really bad toward their employees?
Well, a lot of people single it out, including, I don't know if your listeners will remember this name, but John Gunther, who wrote a book that was very popular in the 50s called Inside USA. And many writers, including Dashiell Hammett, who's the one I really focus on there in the introduction, have talked about Butte and how the company really did next to nothing for the town. There are plenty of negative examples. I think the thing that struck me, and I've been thinking about this topic for a long time, is that there are a lot of positive examples, too, and that things don't always turn out perfectly for companies that set out to build model towns, but it's a whole interesting trend in its own right.
Yeah, I like those stories the most, actually. I love the idea of people trying to create good places for their employees and having libraries and fairly decent housing. It's such a contrast between some of those stories and the other stories, but we forget about those somewhat altruistic people who attempted to make things pretty good.
Right. I think the phrase company town automatically has a kind of negative connotation.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first utopian experiments, if you will, was at Pullman, Illinois, and things didn't turn out so well there, but it was built to be a sort of model showplace town for the company that built the Pullman sleeper cars. Unfortunately, the company regarded the rents on the housing that they only rented, which is not uncommon either. They only rented the housing out to workers and wouldn't sell it. But they regarded the rents as a separate enterprise. And so even though bad economic times came and workers were given short hours at the factory, they maintained the same high rents, and this was an issue in a strike that broke out and became a nationwide strike in the late 1890s. And Pullman became a kind of a negative example that a lot of other town builders would later cite and say, well, look, they tried to build this paternalistic town there and things turned out badly, so we should do very little.
And tell us about the origin of the Pullman cars, too, which I found fascinating. I think that there was an overnight train trip between Buffalo and Westfield, New York, and the conditions were really bad, and he thought people ought to travel in more comfort.
Exactly. George Pullman himself had that experience of being miserable on a train. And train travel back then, of course, was inherently different. The trains were, wood fired or maybe later coal fired, but it could be a kind of dirty experience. And so he had learned to be a craftsman and to take a craftsman attitude toward what the way these cars could actually look. And so he wanted, you know, train travel, and it really, it was kind of the beginning in America. Beginning maybe too strong, but it opened the way for people to think more about tourism. So this too is a kind of theme in my book, is how tourism has been a theme in these company towns from a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. And before we go on to other places, I'm wondering if you can make this a general statement about those who were trying to build utopian kinds of communities. Pleasant working conditions would draw out, this is according to Pullman, the workers' qualities of loyalty, honesty, and perseverance. The employees would work out valuable and well-rounded lives in proportion to their opportunities.
Right. I mean, that was also a goal in early Lowell, Massachusetts, where getting a labor force was an issue, and during a lot of the 19th century, there was kind of a labor shortage in America. But in Lowell, they initially attracted young women workers from the countryside, and they had to make it an appealing place to be because a lot of people, industrial labor was kind of a new thing in America in those days. We're talking about in the years not so long after the Revolution, they wanted to encourage young women to come there and work in the mills, and they created an atmosphere that was really kind of collegiate almost, and like college dormitories with in boarding houses that had women who sort of supervised the lives of these young women. And they wanted to make the whole thing be appealing, not only to the young women, but also to their parents, who would see that they had, you know, pianos in the boarding houses, and it wasn't really a descent into working class life. It was kind of just a recess from a more ideal life.
Mm-hmm. You talk about, and I remember reading this book back in high school, after the events of Pullman, and they were widely reported, you would think that industrial utopianism would be a bygone thing. But the impulse, you write, towards social perfectionism was strong in the late 19th century. And you make reference to Edward Bellamy's book, Looking Backward, 1887, published in 1888. Can you talk about that book a little bit more, and also why that social perfectionism movement was still strong?
Well, I'll talk a little bit about Bellamy first. It was one of the most popular books in 19th century America. It became the equivalent of a bestseller. There were no bestseller lists then, but it really appealed to people because it not only had this kind of element of perfectionism and the idea that society could be made perfect. The theme is, of course, that the protagonist in the novel is a kind of Rip Van Winkle theme. He falls asleep, and when he wakes up, it's at some point in the future. So that the title, Looking Backward, is that he's planted mysteriously at a point in the future when society has perfected itself, and he can remember how bad things had been in his previous life, basically. So this novel became very popular across America, and I think the social perfectionism was partly that we were a new country. Americans felt that they could invent society, they could reinvent society, and I think it also went along with the kind of religious impulse that was common in America, social perfectionism.
Mm-hmm. Are there still company towns in America now?
Yes, of course. I mean, a town that has been a company town and was created as a model town is Hershey, Pennsylvania, and it has developed a more diverse economy now. It has there's a large medical center there, but it's still the home of the chocolate bar maker Hershey, and So it, I think it can still be thought of as a company town. It's a town in which one company really has a lot to say about what goes on there. Across the Midwest, another kind of town I talk about a lot are these meatpacking towns. And Austin, Minnesota, the home of the Hormel company, is it was not a town created by Hormel. It was a small, I think, a railroad town to begin with. But this company grew, you know, gradually, starting in the late 19th or early 20th century. And Hormel always had a great deal of say about what went on in the town. So it's a more informal kind of power that a company like that is able to wield. And there's still a lot of mining towns. There's Morenci, Arizona. The company there is now called Freeport-McMoRan. It's a copper mining company. It used to be Phelps Dodge. So there are still quite a number of company towns around.
How about Kohler, Wisconsin?
Kohler, Wisconsin. Yeah, Kohler is one of the most kind of a sort of surprising transitions. And I point out in the book, if one were to go and Google Kohler, what pops up is something called the Kohler experience. And it takes a while for you to sort out that this is all about the company that does plumbing fixtures. And they now have these very swank ads that you might see in the New Yorker or Vanity Fair or fancy magazines. But they also, a lot of what you see on this website is about golf or about
right.
gourmet weekends. And the company that, you know, that not only makes shower fixtures and toilets, it also is very much into this kind of leisure economy. And they've melded those two elements very cleverly. As I also say in the book, it initially, when Kohler began being very interested in golf, and it was really the Herbert Kohler, the CEO, who seemed to be kind of a golf nut, like a lot of other executives. But somehow, what comes through is that the company has this very interesting model that combines, you know, plumbing fixtures with spas. I mean, another thing you see on the website are that you can go there to this beautiful little town that once used to be a company town, and once used to be for a place for industrial workers, and you can have massages, you can go to these gourmet weekends, you can play golf, and the PGA was recently held in Kohler, and the golf course, I have not been there, but I could see from television, it's really quite spectacular.
Just yes.
Beautiful area. Kohler has made this transition to the tourist economy that I was talking about earlier.
Right. And it's not very accessible, really. It's kind of far away from major urban centers.
Yeah. How does that work?
I don't know. It works somehow.
It seems to. Well, it's in a slightly, it's north of Sheboygan, or north of Milwaukee, I guess.
Right.
And not far from Sheboygan. And it's, the beautiful peninsular area.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for you, and we'll take them in a moment. Our guest this hour is the author of The Company Town, The Industrial Edens and Satanic Mills That Shaped the American Economy. Hardy Green is our guest, author of the book. Here's our phone number for you to join this Labor Day conversation, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, starting with Eugene and Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen. I have three comments. One, I'll add one on. The first one is that you mentioned Kohler, Wisconsin. There was a teacher strike there in 1973, and it really turned bad. And right after that, the state legislature made it illegal for teachers to go on strike. But my other two are, there's a Union Cemetery in the southwest corner of Illinois, I believe just over the line into Missouri, a strictly Union. I visited that a couple times, and it gives a description on the tombstones of when one of those miners were killed and what happened to them. And I think it's the only Union cemetery in the United States. And the third comment is Mary Harris. She was born in Ireland in the 1830s, and she died in this country in about 1930. She was known as Mother Jones, and she was instrumental in organizing unions. And one time, the governor of Colorado had her put on a train and sent out of Colorado and said, if you come back, I'll throw you in jail. She said, I'll be back on the next train, and she was. She didn't quit organizing, didn't quit in the union movement until she was in her 80s.
Were there a lot of unions formed as a result of horrendous working conditions in these company towns?
Oh, sure. But also, I have a chapter on mining towns that mostly focuses on Appalachia, but also on Colorado. And the whole point of a certain kind of company town was to exclude unions. And one of the things that would happen in Appalachia is that all the sheriffs were sort of on the company payroll. So if a union organizer, you know, well, whoever came into town on the train or however they got there, they were questioned quite thoroughly to see what was their purpose in coming there. And if they were union organizers, they were often beaten up and sent out of town. So, even sort of the most towns that thought they had done a lot or companies that thought they'd done a lot for the workers experienced union drives, particularly in the 1930s. A town like Newton, Iowa, which was the home of the Maytag company, Maytag thought they had done a lot, again, very sort of paternalistic towards its employees, but union drives were common in the 1930s, and so it would have been sort of surprising had there not been an attempt to organize a union there. And it was not the company did not react very well to that. He mentioned Kohler. I mean, Kohler was actually the site of the longest labor struggle in American history for a while. Strike that started there in the 1950s, stretched on into the 1960s, and was ultimately resolved by the National Labor Relations Board, which declared it an unfair labor practice strike and required the company to rehire all the strikers and pay their back wages. But so Kohler, has a kind of a funny history. The town was once the site of class warfare in the 1930s. Several people were killed by the armed guards that the company had hired, but now it's much more sort of pleasant and tourist-oriented.
That's quite a change, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you use this word paternalistic. When you look at the utopian kinds of places, was there always an element of, we know what the best life is for you and we're going to create it for you, paternalism?
It certainly was common. I actually tried not to use that word too much because I find that it's kind of pejorative, inherently pejorative, and it's also it's vague. The meaning is sort of vague. The steel barons who built Gary, Indiana, said that the problem had been paternalism in places like Pullman, and that they were not going to be paternalistic. And by that, they really seemed to just mean a company that built housing for the workers. So they didn't want to build any housing, and ultimately they had to. They sort of imagined that they would just build the factories along the lakeshore and that somehow private enterprise would build housing. But it wasn't really working, and the kind of chaotic aftermath paved the way for not a very happy future for Gary, Indiana, which, you know, by the 1960s had become very slum-ridden.
You know, Gary is, when I grew up in Chicago, that area was always so hard to drive through.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Thanks, Eugene. John in Madison is next. Hi, John.
Hello. I just wanted to ask your guest if he felt this applied to Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And just as a side note, it wasn't always a positive thing. Then, in some people's minds, Mayo's influence there, you know, employing more than a quarter of the population today. But I'm wondering if Mayo falls into this category.
Well, it could. I mean, I think the category is also inherently a little vague. And one of the things I've noticed, I Googled company town early on in this project, and one of the first things that came up was a blog from the Los Angeles Times. They have a blog called Company Town, which is all about the entertainment industry in Hollywood. Well, you know, Hollywood and Los Angeles are not company towns by my terms. They're you know, complicated metropolitan areas with a lot of different diverse economic goings on. But it might well be that, you know, that I don't know Rochester that well. So I suspect that there is a lot of different kinds of enterprise there, but it's also undoubtedly true that the Mayo Clinic has lots of power there.
Mm-hmm.
Both them and IBM really they control the town, more so Mayo Clinic now, but because IBM has lost a significant amount of their employees, but Mayo dominates the community, and what Mayo says, that's what goes in that community.
One of the interesting things about this is I expect to learn a lot as I go around and talk about my book, is that everyone has another example to bring up, so that when I initially told my Business Week colleagues I was writing the book, they were full of ideas. People told me, one colleague said he was from Velsetz, Oregon, which is a small lumbering town, and another guy was from Export, Pennsylvania, which is a coal mining town. So that that number of 2,500 company towns in America doesn't seem, you know, like a stretch.
And thanks for the call. What about Google?
Well, Google, that was brought to my attention by my agent, who said that he pointed out that Google had been secretly building this server farm in the woods in Washington State. And for some reason, people are sort of suspicious of Google. It may have to do with their power and with the fact that they have this motto that do no evil, I think, and that inherently puts people sort of on their guard. But Google, like a number of enterprises that are now arising in America, will probably never really employ very many people there. They do have this sort of off-limits facility. It's no longer a secret. It's not too far from Portland. But I think it's really never going to be a company town. It's much more like a kind of a lighthouse where it's somewhat remote. It'll require a small workforce. It's mostly populated by computer servers. And the same, I think, is true of the growing number of solar facilities in the Southwest, that those two will never really be company towns because they will never really require a large population. They're mostly going to be sites for machines.
Here's an interesting email from Alan. Some years back, I went on the train from Milwaukee to Ann Arbor. I was quite fascinated as we pulled into Battle Creek, Michigan. The influence of breakfast cereal was everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
The station is beautiful and obviously enhanced by millions of American breakfasts.
Yeah, I've never been to Battle Creek. I'm sure that's interesting.
Yeah. Let's go next to Stephen in Fish Creek. Hi, Stephen.
Good morning.
Hi.
I grew up somewhat in Kohler, Wisconsin, and my father was born there, and I can remember that strike really well, and I can remember strikers in my grandfather's kitchen. And when you think back about it, it's a little scary, almost like Stepford Wives or something, that Kohler Company built the town, built all of the houses, built a little model shopping center with a pharmacy, built the schools, laid out all the streets, and they owned all of that. And thus, if you got a job at the Kohler Company, you got a mortgage from the bank, and everything was tied together so that if you lost your job, you often lost your home and lost your entire position in that community. So that was what was so completely almost like the Middle Ages, where there was such a ruling aristocracy that controlled everything. And it's what created, in my opinion, such an angry oppositional strike. But, you know, now we've evolved. And I can remember when I was a kid, the space where that wonderful championship golf course now is down along the river, that was community gardens. And that was at least one of the positive sides of living in Kohler, is that everybody walked down to those garden spaces and they had these beautiful gardens. Each person had their own little plot. And, you know, those are some of the memories I have of Kohler to share with you. And I'll just let you reflect on that on Labor Day.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thanks. Great show.
All right. Thanks.
Yeah, the caller makes a really good point, and maybe I've neglected to say more about that, but many of these towns, the companies owned everything, and it might seem like, you know, benevolence, but a town like Kannapolis, North Carolina, for example, was an unincorporated town built by the Cannon Towel Company, and they donated the funds to build a hospital. There really was no government, so the company provided all the municipal services, from garbage collection to, you know, the ambulances to police. Every aspect of life in the town, from the housing, you paid rent to the company, and this is a model that's kind of all embracing. It there was a sociologist a number of years ago named Irving Goffman who came up with this idea of the total institution, and the army, for example, would be a total institution where they really control all aspects of your life. But it seems to me that these certain kinds of company towns are like that as well, that every aspect of your life is controlled by the company. And if, as the caller said, if you were to lose your job, you would be disinherited from virtually everything that you'd known.
Where did people, that's what I wanted to ask him, but if you lost your job, then you'd lose your house and the
yes.
whole town is the company. So where did people go?
Well, or if you went on strike, I mean, that was common, too.
Yes,
and
right.
I guess, you know, it became a matter of individual choice to a degree. You know, you'd just be set adrift. But, I mean, in some of the mining towns, coal mining towns, if you were to die, your family would be kicked out of the company housing. So where would they go? You know, they would have to figure that out.
Mm-hmm. You say early in the book, and I'd like for you to talk more about this, that the U.S. has a unique experience with company towns, that we've provided a greater opportunity for developing such settlements than other countries.
I think it's because a lot of these towns were coming into being as the country was being settled. And, you know, there are company towns, for example, in France or in England. There were a number of model towns built in England by, there was a famous one called Port Sunlight that was built by the Cadbury Company. And the Hershey Company kind of modeled Hershey, Pennsylvania on the experience of the Cadbury Company town. But, you know, there's only so much space in those countries to build a new town and to you know, engage in social experimentation, and more space in the United States, the wide open spaces.
Yeah. Tom in Kenosha, hi.
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 Yeah, Brokaw, Wisconsin, just north of Wausau, was also built as a company town around the Wausau paper mills.
Hmm.
Settled in this little valley. They had a large boarding house where the single men that worked in the paper mill boarded. They had a clubhouse with bowling lanes, school. Duplexes were put up for the families, too. They had a company store that used company script for a while.
Right.
And pretty interesting. It's well documented at the Marathon County Historical Museum. Great photo collection of the community and all the events that took place, baseball games, that type of thing, too.
Yes, that's a good point also about the company money. I mean, many of your listeners will know about that, but some of these companies were so controlling that they actually paid workers in their own money
rather than
you know, U.S. currency.
Wow. You know, even in the best of places, it sounds so incredibly controlling, and if you wanted to branch out and go fly on your own, it would be hard to do. There's something that's creepy about all of this, isn't there?
There is. It's a little Big Brotherish, and it seems like, I mean, one of the things I say in the book is that company towns seem un-American, and yet they're kind of the essence of America. And it's a funny contradiction that there are so many of them, and the history of company towns in America is really makes up for a pretty good history of American economic development.
Yeah. Here's one about, and this is what, I just dropped my son off at college yesterday, and Now we have an email. He's thinking the same lines that I am today. Nathan from Green Bay, could you have your guest comment on the differences and similarities between company towns and college towns? We have many small colleges that are vital to small town life here in the Midwest.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is a similarity. And, you know, a town like Madison is much more complicated. It's a state capital, obviously, but the university plays a big role in the life of that town. And he's right. I mean, there are many smaller towns where a college or a university really dominates, so much so that if people don't have a tie to the university, they probably feel excluded in some way.
Right. Tom, thank you for your call. A couple lines are open if you'd like to join our conversation. The author of The Company Town, The Industrial Edens and Satanic Mills That Shaped the American Economy, Hardy Green, is with us this hour. And we go to Charles from Ingleside, Illinois next. Hello, Charles. Happy Labor Day.
Kathy, I want to make sure that the Massachusetts Bay Colony is mentioned when John Winthrop came over as governor and also head of the board. And Boston then was one of the beginnings of our democracy, but they had town meetings, and they decided everything happened in Boston, and they set up all the little farms around Boston, and they gave the same charter, illegally, but they did it, the same charter for the people that founded the towns then were board members, and they voted for all the progress and every penny that was spent for the town, just like a corporation would. And that's where our democracy started in this country. I want to make sure you mention that.
Okay.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, mostly what I'm focused on are more industrial towns, and that's sort of earlier than there was any industry in the United States.
Thanks, Charles, so much for your call. Betty is next from Oak Creek. Hi, Betty.
Hi. What an interesting program. I've been a few series, now reruns, I've had a little time, watched the Undercover Boss. And it's amazing how it really made an influence on him as to how hard these people work for the little bit of money and what hardship they have. And do you think this will start some big corporations to kind of think again as how they're treating their employees?
I had a little difficulty hearing you. I think you must be calling on the cell phone. But I find there's a couple of things going on now. Of course, we're in the middle of a recession, and companies, many of them kind of expect to just have their way and get whatever they would want without having to do anything special. But it's also the case that there is a kind of funny return to what was once known as welfare capitalism going on, with a number of companies helping workers with their housing needs. One such company is the large drug chain. I don't know if it exists in the Midwest, called CVS, and they have helped workers to subsidize a lot of their housing costs. And there's a lot going on in the Chicago area in this regard. So it's kind of a funny time, a mixed time. But the social safety net that government provides is also, you know, atrophied. And so there's a kind of a need. If an employer wants to have a stable workforce and to keep people on board, they may have to, you know, provide more in the way of benefits.
Thank you, Betty, very much for the call. I think we need to go back to Hershey for a little while, because this is an incredible endeavor, and Milton Hershey's wife wanted an industrial school, a residential institution for orphan boys. There were no cemeteries or funeral homes in Hershey. It became a place that people would visit, perhaps. It was that kind of a model town.
Yeah, it was early on, people from out of town would go there just to sort of look around. And, and it could be that experience encouraged the sort of slow development. I mean, they had kind of a Hershey Park for a long time that was free, and that I think they must have known that that adults weren't the only ones who liked chocolate, that kids liked it too. And now there's a kind of a Hershey Park that's really like a Disneyland there. So, and that you know, charges admission. So you can't really get a tour, for example, of the chocolate works, but you can certainly buy all you want. And the as far as the orphanage goes, Milton Hershey, the founder of the town, built it in a way as a kind of memoriam to his wife. He felt that they should spend some of their money to the benefit of orphans. So they built this school, and it was Milton gave his stock, all of his stock holdings, to the school, and so it has this incredible endowment that has really meant that if you get to go there, you really are getting to go to one of the best schools.
Hmm. And I'm wondering about these company towns, if they had a reputation as being pretty good places and places that were very good to their employees, would there be a subsequent movement to buy the product because they were so good to their employees? And the opposite side of that is, if there was a major strike and conditions were deplorable, would there be boycotts of places because of how they treated their employees?
I'm sure that both of those things happen. Is that that having a sort of a model town that would radiate goodwill and that would encourage people to buy the product. If there was sort of a nasty labor situation there, that could have the opposite effect.
We welcome more phone calls in just one moment. The author of The Company Town, Hardy Green, is our guest this Labor Day. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to Virginia in Milwaukee next. Hi, Virginia.
Well, good morning, Kathleen, and good morning to your guest.
Hi.
I'm listening to you, and I wasn't sure if I heard, because I've kind of been in and out of my apartment. Did you mention this Henry Ford, maker of the automobile, and the town that he set up and his ideals for his workers?
Yeah, Dearborn, which is it's now part of Detroit. I'm not sure actually whether it maintains a certain kind of separate identity, but it's really, you know, very much a part of the Detroit metropolitan area. But it had a kind of a separate identity and was really very much controlled by the Ford Motor Company. The mayor, you know, they had elected officials, unlike some of these company towns, but they were really also Ford company executives. So Dearborn really was pretty much under the thumb of Ford, as Gary, Indiana was under the thumb of General Motors.
The reason I mentioned it is because I had read that Henry Ford had his own philosophy about, shall we say, a, quote, clean living, and thought that that's the way his employees should live, too. So he endorsed that kind of and tried to show his employees that if you don't go out drinking the night before, you'll be able to get to work and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, this is very common for the kind of moguls who build company towns to be very interested in their employees' personal lives and to particularly want drinking to be barred from the towns. Henry Ford famously had a department of the Ford Motor Company called the Sociological Department that functioned both as a kind of social welfare department and as a kind of an espionage apparatus. So they might help you get a loan to buy a house, but they might also get you fired for smoking or drinking or for owning a General Motors car.
Oh, my goodness.
Good one there.
Yeah. Woo-hoo. Anything else, Virginia? Oh, she said thank you so much, I think. Thank you, Virginia, for your call. There's not a lot in the book about this, but I wonder if you know more of the story. This is an email from Jan in Delafield. Can you talk about the history of Alice Chalmers and West Alice?
Oh, not really, no. It's too bad she didn't call, because she could have probably told us about it.
Yeah, right. Okay.
That's not really included.
All right, Jan, if you want to call, that would be fine. We go to Steele in Appleton. Hi, Steele.
Hey, good morning, everyone.
Hi.
I was wondering what your guest knows about the relationship between Johnson & Johnson and Racine, Wisconsin. He had made the comment of Hershey Park was free. And when I came here in the late 90s, one of the most beautiful spots for a zoo was right on the lake in Racine, and it used to be free, but a couple years ago, now there's a fee. I'd always put a couple bucks in, but I was curious about that relationship and some of the beautiful architecture that was involved in all that.
Well, tell us what you know. I mean, there again, it's not a place that I've researched very much, but tell us what you know about it.
Oh, well, I don't know a whole lot about it. I just know, they make a lot of stuff there. Maybe the host could give us a two-minute history.
I'm not sure the host knows a two-minute history. The only thing I am aware of are that they have some, have in the past, had some wonderful seminars at, they have a building where they bring in great thinkers from really all over the world for seminars on a variety of issues, which is nice. They sponsor those. I don't know anything about the zoo, though, Steele. Are they?
Oh, it's beautiful. Oh.
I'll have to go. But is Johnson & Johnson affiliated with the zoo somehow?
Well, actually, it was free. And then I read an article 3-4 years ago, the new son or, you know, whoever's in charge decide, well, now you have to pay, which, you know, it would make sense to me, but I was just flabbergasted that it was free to the public.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Steele, very much for the call. I used to go to those seminars, too. They were always wonderful.
You would think a facility like that would be also be goodwill for the company and good advertising, so I don't know, I don't know anything about it, but the idea that it was free seems like something they might have wanted to continue, but maybe they just felt they couldn't.
Right. Thanks, Steele, very much for the call. Arnold is joining us from Madison. Hi, Arnold.
Oh, I've written quite a bit about company towns in the upper Midwest, so I thought it might be interesting for the listeners to hear about a few others they could visit, too. One of the really classic examples in the region is Morgan Park, Minnesota, right over the border from Superior, which was built by the U.S. Steel Corporation shortly after they built Gary, Indiana.
Oh. Uh-huh.
And this, what I find interesting about them, I often look at the physical design of these communities, which are, that's really an interesting facet of it because they are utopian in that sense, too. But Morgan Park, like many other company towns I've looked at, they might be utopias, but then they typically have thin suburbs next door where the, where the taverns would be and the prostitution and things of that nature.
Mm.
So you can, Oliver, Wisconsin, for example, became the thin suburb of Morgan Park. And there's a great deal of animosity sometimes between the company and what is going on in Oliver at the time. And there were a couple of places in Minnesota next door called New Duluth and Gary as well.
Now, was Morgan Park actually, was actually steel making that went on there, or was this a mining town?
It was a steel making town, yeah. And the idea was that Minnesotans were getting so upset that U.S. Steel was taking all the iron ore, shipping it to steel mills in the eastern United States. So they threatened to impose a tax on U.S. Steel and its ore reserves, but in exchange, then U.S. Steel agreed to put in a steel plant in Duluth.
Uh-huh.
That was a gentleman's agreement, and they created a model town as a result, too.
I see.
And I could also point out one other small one in Wisconsin, which has that whole idea of sin suburbs again, is in the Hurley area, which is a town known for its rowdiness, there's a model town called Montreal, which was built for the Ogilvy Norton Company. And even today, the mining has long gone, but it's become somewhat of a ski lodge community where people have taken over the small company towns and turned them into their little retreats for wintertime. And when you go into it, it's almost like entering a New England community. And then finally, I'll make a comment about Kohler. They did hire these very well-known planners, Warner Hageman and Albert Peets, but especially the Olmsted brothers,
right,
to come in and create this utopian existence. What I think is so ironic, though, is when you go to the American Club today, which is now a five-star hotel and restaurant,
right,
that was the place where the immigrants who came from Germany and Austria were housed in these small little cells, like dormitory rooms. So there's been that interesting transition from that sort of environment into this very, very expensive sort of place today.
Yeah, they point out on their website that the American Hotel was once a place that housed immigrant workers, but you can't tell, well, what did these immigrant workers do? It takes a little, like I said, a little searching around to try and find out that this is the company that started off. When they began, they were taking these sort of hog scalders, big tubs, and turning them into bathtubs that they sold to immigrants for the most part. And so, you know, it was a sort of a gritty, had a kind of gritty origins, and now it's all spiffed up.
Thank you so much for your call, Arnold, and all that information. Can you discuss, here's an email that's come in from Corbin, how some employees really liked the company town arrangements. I lived in Anaconda, Montana for a while, and people there recalled fondly the company that ran the town and the smelter. The town basically died when the smelter closed.
Well, Anaconda is right next to Butte. It was a company town built by the Anaconda Company. So I'm a little surprised to hear that they have fond memories, but maybe absence makes the heart grow fonder. Certainly it was the case in Hershey that when the people enjoyed living there, and there was a strike there in the 1930s, and the townspeople who were not on strike and the farmers who sold milk to the company really were up in arms against the strikers. And so, you know, a lot of people have an attitude toward towns like that they are kind of the golden goose and don't want anything to disrupt the company or make the company think of moving somewhere else.
Hmm. We go next to Scott in Green Bay. Hi, Scott.
Well, I wanted to say that it seems like the entire corporate system is almost like a giant company town because some corporations are intertwined with each other and own different parts. At one point in the U.S. history, it used to be no corporation could own another corporation. But it's almost like no matter what you buy, Corporation X is going to at least profit from it. And like even if you own like a small business, mom and pop business, you still end up buying supplies from a giant, you know, a corporation somehow in a company town in a way. Guess that's all.
Right. Well, corporations have a lot of say about what goes on in America.
Right. And we do want to clear up when we were talking about it's S.C. Johnson is the place in Racine, not Johnson & Johnson. I think I call it Johnson & Johnson. It's not. It's S.C. Johnson. All right. Let's go next to Carolyn from Madison. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. Tom Hartman reminds people every once in a while that when it comes to small d democracy, you find that in labor unions, because most corporations, and this show just really kind of hit that home, corporations are an awful lot like fiefdoms and royalty and not necessarily democratic, where labor unions, you know, where people sit down and talk with each other and, you know, come up with agreements. You know, the hard slog of democracy is in the unions.
Cardi.
I wish that were true. I mean, I've had experiences where unions are not so democratic themselves. And, you know, they're really, I don't know whether it's a matter of the way the law creates things in America, but a lot of labor unions are really like small businesses, and the officers come to regard the union as their personal property, and the idea that there might be an insurgency that would throw them out of office is regarded as horrible. So, I don't know, I'm not anti-union, but I think it's not quite as rosy, the picture's not quite as rosy as the caller paints.
And how did you happen to write a book on this? Did you grow up in one of these towns, or?
No, not at all. I think it really, I had a lot of experience going to a lot of places that were, I once worked for the, speaking of labor unions, I once worked for the Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union, and I went to a lot of textile towns in the South as a result. But I think the thing that mostly influenced my thinking was that an experience with Austin, Minnesota, and the Hormel Company. And there, as I said before, you could really see that This was a company that had not created the town, but was certainly the most important employer anywhere around and had a great deal of say-so in the local media. In some towns, these companies would actually might employ the teachers or employ the ministers. And Hormel didn't do that, obviously, but they had a lot of control over what got said in the churches and the schools. And so it was this kind of informal power was very interesting to me and made me, you know, sort of interested in the topic in general.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Hardy Green, for being with us. It was a very interesting hour. Lots of people calling in.
It went very quickly. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, you're very welcome, and happy Labor Day. He's the author, Hardy Green, of The Company Town, The Industrial Edens and Satanic Mills That Shaped the American Economy. He's former associate editor at Business Week, where he was responsible for the magazine's book review coverage and has written for Reuters, Fortune, and AOL's Daily Finance. He has taught history at Stony Brook University. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios on this Labor Day, the 6th of September. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Thanks for all of your calls, everybody. You're right with it. Not sleeping in today, you hard workers who deserve this day off. So we will be with you again tomorrow at 9 o'clock, talking about interesting topics. And, of course, great conversations are ahead. So stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.